الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر
Assalamu alaikum. Peace be upon you, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another of our episodes of Islam in Focus. This is going to be program number 8 on Islamic beliefs, and more specifically, it's going to be the 7th episode on the concept of monotheism in Islam. Our guest on today's program is Dr. Jamal Badawi. Assalamu alaikum, Dr. Jamal. Welcome to the program. Let us start, as usual, by quickly recapping what we covered last time.
Okay, what we did last time was to more or less conclude our discussion of the positive or affirmative divine attributes of Allah, God, capital G. And last time there were two basic issues that we spent most of the time on. The first is to correct one of the common errors and misconceptions that when Islam insists on the absolute perfection and transcendence of God, that this necessarily means that he is a remote, unapproachable God. And we said that this is not true. We have given plenty of evidence from the Quran, the word of God himself, in which we have shown the complete consistency between the perfection, transcendence of God on one hand, alongside or hand in hand with the attributes of mercy, forgiveness, and personal relationship or closeness to mankind. This was one issue. The second major issue we discussed was the attribute of forgiveness, with a special reference for comparative purposes with the concept of original sin. And we said that in Islam, this concept does not exist. There is no original sin in Islam. There's no parallel at all. And we said that the sin is not to be inherited by other human beings, that as the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, said, that every child is born innocent and pure, and that in case we err or sin, the only way to atone or remit that sin is to pray directly to God and seek His forgiveness, so long as we are sincere in this earnest prayer and our intention also to avoid falling into this sins and errors. And we concluded the session last time by indicating that we are not here on earth by way of punishment for a sin committed hundreds or thousands of years ago by Adam and Eve. We are here because we have a certain mission that we are destined to perform and we are created specifically for on earth.
Great. Before we move to the implications of those attributes in our daily life, let's first clarify something that is sometimes bothering when we read the literature, the Western literature about Islam by Orientalists or Islamic researchers, if you will. And that is the idea of simplicity in the Islamic creed. Sometimes they relegate the Islamic creed or sort of shrug their shoulders to it and mar it and label it as being too simplistic for simple-minded nomadic people, and it does not aspire to compete, so to speak, or come up to the level of other esoteric creeds that we see in other faiths or religions. What do you say about that?
You see, even when the term simplistic is not used, it is clearly insinuated.
Implied, yeah.
Yeah, I've seen so many writings written by non-Muslims, so many films, for example, or TV programs produced that starts with a statement like that. Oh, Islam is very simple. There is only one God. Simple. And then talk about the five pillars of Islam. So just in one quick sentence, you're really insinuating very obviously that somehow Islam is simple in a sense of being simplistic, so equating simple with simplistic
superficial.
By the same token, people also sometimes tend to get the impression that complicated is sophisticated or more profound, whereas we know that the simplest facts, you could make it very complex unduly. You can include all kind of philosophical and theological riddles into something that's very straightforward and very simple and make it complex but not necessarily sophisticated or true. So this is the difficulty with the terminology that's being used. I would say that the most profound truths are ones that combines both simplicity and depth, but not simplisticness. Simplicity and depth. The most manifest example indeed of this is our discussion in the last few sessions on this aspect of monotheism, or the absolute oneness of the Creator, of God. We have seen that on one level, a very simple person, perhaps even uneducated, unsophisticated, if you explain to him that there is only one Creator, that the whole universe is created by one God, one authority, it is palatable, it's acceptable by the person. He can understand that. Mm-hmm. All right. But on the other hand, we have seen also that we have spent six complete programs. This is the seventh, perhaps the last one, that deals specifically with that single concept of monotheism. And we haven't even delved into greater depth. We simply tried to give some examples of the Quran of what the real dimensions and meaning of this monotheism really mean. We have seen in our discussion that on one level, the discussion is appealing even to the most scientific mind, especially when we discuss the various signs of God's oneness in our creation, in the ecological balance, in the total cosmos, or the creation of the total universe. So in that sense, I'm saying that a very profound truth could be simple on one level and very deep also for those who care to delve more into the dimensions and understanding of what it really means. And in fact, I would say that the kind of insinuation that is made normally from these writings is not only by words, but also by the way these programs are produced, or those films, for example, are produced, or pictures in books. You get a typical uneducated person in flowing robes, riding on a camel. He looks like almost a savage, and tie it somehow with this understanding of monotheism, and say, yeah, one God. What is even more tricky that we should be really careful about, that some scholars, non-Muslim scholars, fall into an error of saying, yes, monotheism in Islam is good. It's a better and very profound idea, but only relative to its time. That is, compared to the idol worship that was rampant at the time when Prophet Muhammad came, it's better. It's an improvement. Somehow insinuating again, but not as compared.
Not absolutely.
Not absolutely. Whereas, as we have seen, even in this very scanty coverage in seven sessions, mm-hmm. that the concept of monotheism in Islam definitely. In a category by itself, as you compare it with any explanation given by any faith, or even by any philosophy, for that matter.
Good. I'm glad we clarified that before we move to the last topic about monotheism, because I think it does disturb you when you read about it and sort of be faced with it in about Islam, the West. Now we come to the last. Subtitle under monotheism, if you will, and that is the implication. Now, some people would say that talking about the Islamic creed in depth, or even shortly, is a sort of a futile exercise, or an intellectual exercise that doesn't have any implication in our daily lives. Is it practical? Does it have direct implications in our daily life? And if yes,
on a superficial look.
Yeah,
I'm using now simplistic. When you have a simplistic look at it, it may sound like just like a theological or philosophical type of argument.
Yeah.
But when you really delve into some more depth into this, you'll find that even not only the concept of monotheism, but each of the basic divine attributes that we have discussed does have a practical relevance, a practical implication in the day-to-day life of various individuals. It is manifest in our life, in the life of a believer, both on the individual as well as the collective levels.
Great. Maybe we should be a little bit more specific on that, and let's take some of them, some of the attributes that we've talked about, and discuss the implications of each one of them individually. Let's start with the most important, namely oneness. What implication does it have?
Okay. Again, it sounds, like I said, as just a theological type of argument. When you really think about oneness of Allah, first of all, when you talk about one or the one creator and master of the whole universe, this in itself provides a base for humanity to unite. That is, you're talking about one common Lord of the universe. Yeah. So the whole issue of religious prejudice or racial prejudice or any other thing that stems or is typically expressed in terms of your God, my God, and all that would have no place, because we're not talking about your God or my God, we're talking about the God and the Lord of the entire universe, the whole of humanity. It follows from this also that since you have one Lord, one Creator of the universe, that you also have one humanity. The oneness of Allah also leads to the oneness of humanity. And this understanding of oneness of humanity is also a very profound basis to remove all the artificial barriers of racial superiority, tribal superiority, color superiority, and all other false method that people have devised to distinguish between one group of the creatures of Allah and others. It follows also from both of them, that is, when you have oneness of Allah, oneness of humanity, that you have also oneness of divine revelation. By that we mean that all the messages, divine revelation that were received by all prophets throughout history is like links in a constant and continuous chain of revelation, that the prophets should be viewed by their followers not as competitors who are just snatching the souls of people or competing for them, but rather those who are carrying basically the same message of goodness, of submission to the will of God, while at the same time completing and complementing what each prophet before them has done, as we said before, culminating finally in the message of Prophet Muhammad as the last of those prophets. So all of them are brothers. Their followers, if they are true followers, should also try to be brothers. So if you take this even as one concept in terms of oneness, we find that in the very practical, realistic sense, it provides a very strong foundation to unify the entire humanity. Sometimes, as humans, we fail to harness that potential. We don't benefit from that potential because of the various biases, prejudices that we have, brainwashing that we have because of various individual, social or institutional pressures on us. But the potential is there in this single concept of oneness here.
Right. Okay, if we move from oneness to the second attribute, which is the uniqueness of the Creator, in other terms, Allah being the sole Creator, does this have an implication on the Allah?
It sure does. By believing that Allah, or God, capital G, is the sole creator of everything that is in this universe, animate and inanimate objects, mm-hmm. It follows also that a true believer does not feel that anything in this universe is totally strange to him. There are things that we may not understand, but the universe does not sound like something that you should fear. A Muslim should never use the term conquer or conquest of nature, subduing nature. Because it appears from this terminology very common in the West as if you're in a struggle with an enemy that is nature. Mm-hmm. For the Muslim, he doesn't look at it this way. He says nature is the creation of Allah. There's nothing called Mother Nature. God created that nature. And he created it specifically for our benefit, in order to harness its resources for the purpose of achieving our mission on this earth. So nothing really looks very strange to the believer. Not only this, we find also that once we realize that Allah or God is the creator, then we conclude also that there must be a specific purpose and wisdom behind creating us on this earth. We're not just created here to live and die. That's not the purpose. There must be a more noble mission. And that is the basic distinction between human beings on one hand and other living organisms or animals or birds or other types of creation. This has been beautifully depicted in one passage in the Quran. والذين كفروا يتمتعون ويأكلون كما تأكل الأنعام. While those who reject God will enjoy this world and eat as cattle eat, and the fire will be their abode. That's in 47:12. So that's the crux of the matter. By knowing and realizing the attribute of creation of Allah, then we try to ask ourselves, why are we created and what mission are we supposed to fulfill on this earth?
Right. Okay, maybe we can move now to a concept that sounds, if we look at it superficially, as being a passive attribute, and its implication may not be readily obvious, and that is the attribute of knowledge and wisdom. When we say that Allah is all knowledgeable and all wise, or omniscient and omnipotent, so to speak, does this have an implication in knowledge?
This also has implication. You look at it from the point of view of knowledge or wisdom, they both have very practical implication. First of all, when a believer realizes and believes that all his deeds, all his action on this earth are watched, that God is watching over what you're doing, and as we said last time, even your inner thoughts are known to the Creator, it follows from that this would help the believer to inculcate in himself or herself the quality of taqwa, piety, or more correctly, Allah consciousness, to be God conscious in your activities. It leads you to have automatic self-policing. You don't have someone to watch over you or to tell you what to do, because you're, after all, in direct contact, under direct observation of the Creator. And this quality is not a theoretical quality, it's a very essential quality to build any healthy community or society. The other aspect that follows from that is that the believer's view of morality or moral standards would be much more lofty than what most people look at morality. That is to say, many people would accept moral values, but they accept it only in a utilitarian sense. That is, I have to comply with this moral standard because it's good for me, it's good for my business, it's good to get social approval or something of that sort. Well, that could be useful, but that's not all. Because a more lofty level of looking at morality is to tie it directly to the knowledge of God, to saying, I follow those standards because God knows me. If I cheat people, if I use this pretense of morality just to acquire the admiration or applaud of other people, then if I can cheat all those people, I cannot cheat God himself. So that inculcates the quality also of sincerity in deeds, thoughts, and words. If you take the question of wisdom also as one absolute attribute of the Creator, we find that it also relates to the acceptance of God's commands and directions and guidance as the ultimate source, because a believer believes that God is the ultimate infallible sovereign and source of knowledge, the ultimate lawgiver, if you will. Once we inculcate in ourselves this, then we take God and his commands as the arbiter to judge in anything that we as human beings differ on. So it gives a kind of stability to the law, just in the same sense, with the difference, of course, that the Constitution provides stability within which various flexible laws can be devised.
Right.
So in that sense, you get also stability in legal system, taking the absolute commands of God as ultimate
as the final
arbiter.
Okay, let's move to another attribute, and that is the attribute of forgiveness. When we say that God is forgiving or all forgiving, what kind of implications should we see in that attribute?
I think it's very essential, because even though the concept of sin might sound like a theological argument, but it's not really, because it relates to the whole psychology of the individual and how he or she understands the world around him. But I would say, first of all, this concept of God as the ultimate source of forgiveness liberate the human mind from the stigma, from the shackles resulting from concepts like original sin, for example, whereby the sin is inherited. And as we said before, that this is contrary to the justice of God to have that stigma or curse for the whole descendants of Adam and Eve, because two of them made some mistake. By accepting that the authority of forgiveness lies exclusively in the hands of God, of Allah, the human mind is also liberated from any superstition or any strange ideas about how to remit for those sins. And as we indicated, again, the Islamic way of remission is to sincerity, stopping what you're doing that you feel is wrong and immoral, and turning back to God in repentance and sincerity. It could also avoid in the tendency in human beings to deify human beings in the hope that those human beings might take care of their sins. And as we mentioned before, this tendency was not limited in one case or the other. There have been so many cases in history where people were believed to be deity or manifestation or incarnation of deity, even though those individuals themselves have emphatically denied that, never claimed that they are anything more than sincere human beings. It also removes or discourages the exploitation of people in the name of religion. Because once you start on a path of intermediary or intercession between man and God, even if you talk about great prophets as intercessors, then somebody else would claim that I am the intercessor to the intercessor. So everybody, you get a whole chain. And that would give rise, as it happened in history, to exploitation of people in the name of religion. As you know, in history there were cases where people even took the power unto themselves to grant forgiveness to people. You pay so much money and you get a document saying that your sins have been forgiven. Islam insists forgiveness only lies in the hands of Allah. And that's why, in a way, Islam does not accept the concept of priesthood as it's understood in the West. They could be religious scholars, but not priests in the terminological sense. And finally, I could add one more point, that the belief in the forgiveness of Allah as the final authority leads the person to have a sense of responsibility and accountability. Mm-hmm. He does not depend on, somebody else would take care of my sins. No, you are accountable individually before God, and as such, you have this sense of trying your best to follow His commands. I could perhaps give one example of this from the Quran in 82:19. Mm-hmm. It says, it will be the day, that's the day of judgment, when no soul shall have power to do anything for another, for the command that day will be holy with God. So all of these are very relevant issues, like I said, in practice, and they all tie back to this whole concept of God as the forgiver alone, with no intercession or no intermediary.
Beautiful. Can we move now to mercy and see what kind of implications does the attribute of mercy have in all this?
Well, in a sense, you could say that mercy relates to forgiveness that we have just discussed, so maybe you can just add a few more points. Mm-hmm. It also relates to the inculcating the attitude of gratefulness to God, to the Creator. That is, we don't take all the blessings or the bounties that God has given us for granted. We know that this is manifestation of His mercy. Even the glass of water that we drink, even the smell of fresh air that we have, we should always remember and think that this is a manifestation of the mercy of Allah. Mm-hmm. It also gives the person a feeling of assurance that there is one who cares for me. I could be sinful, I could be bad, but still there is one who cares and loves me and have mercy on me. And it's not anyone, He is the one, the final authority in this universe. So that gives a warm feeling of identification with God, with the Creator. In case the person faces any problem or difficulty in his life, he should never feel brokenhearted, he should not despair. Because as the Quran says, one should never despair from the mercy of Allah. In fact, in 39:53 it says, despair not of the mercy of Allah. In another citation, in 12:87, it says, no one despairs of God's soothing mercy except those who have no faith. As the prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, said it once, he said, I wonder about the affairs of a true believer. Whatever happens to him is good. If something good happened to him, he thanks God or Allah. He gets reward for that. If something difficult befalls him, or adversity, he again thanks Allah or have perseverance and patience, and he gets also a reward for it.
Right. Okay, now let's move to the omnipotence of Allah, the absolute will and power of Allah. In what sense should this attribute affect us personally on our day now?
By realizing that all power belongs only in the hands of God, this would remove any servitude to any other human being. Servitude that we have for other people like ourselves simply because we have some hopes that they will benefit us in some form. The Quran says no, the benefit comes only from Allah, not from any other human being. These are only tools. It also removes this servitude to other human beings in a sense of fear for them. And that is why we find prophets and other deeply religious individuals throughout history have been standing in the face of all tyranny with great deal of courage in saying the word of truth, not to satisfy anyone, but because this is the truth that should be said. It removes also the excessive or undue anxiety that people might have about what is happening to them or will happen to them. As the Quran says, nothing will happen to us except what God has destined us to go through. Nobody would live for one moment more or less than what has been decided for him. It also causes us to be more humble, realizing that all the power is in the hand of God. So whatever we have by way of wealth, position, or whatever, we should be humble, because we know that God can take it at any time, so that we don't exploit other people. We don't use this power or wealth or influence for our own benefit. We realize that we have a purpose also to serve by having this. And even in the area of political life and government, we realize again that the ultimate authority lies in the hand of God, and as such, all other humans should be really equal in his sight, and their affairs should be by mutual consultation.
Great. We have made it a point last time to eliminate the misconception rampant in Western literature again as to the remoteness of Allah to the Muslims. And we said that closeness to mankind is a very important attribute of Allah. Could we terminate this discussion by giving the implications of the closeness to Allah?
Okay, of course, aside from the various passages from the Quran, which I quoted before, that shows that God is closer to man than his jugular vein, that God is close to anyone who pray to him, that in Islam there is no intermediary, and in the five daily prayers you pray and communicate directly. This is the most noble, direct and close and warm personal relationship that you could have with the Creator. In addition to this, this kind of experience or concept gives the person a chance to have a spiritual experience of direct contact with God, which would lead inevitably to the feeling of peace in mind and peace of heart, which is the most valuable thing that anyone can attain in this life. Don't tell me about big cars and big houses and lots of money in the bank, or gold with whatever $500 an ounce or more. These are all superficial. The real peace, the real value in life, is to have this inner peace in the heart and mind. Just to conclude, perhaps by quoting a few passages from the Quran. وَمَنْ يُؤْمِنْ بِاللَّهِ يَهْدِ قَلْبَهُ. Whoso believes in God or Allah, God will guide his heart. All right. And that's in 64:11. In a second quotation also, in 2:57, God or Allah is the protector of those who have faith. He will lead them from the depths of darkness into light. And those who reject faith, their patrons are the evil ones. They will lead them forth from light into the depths of darkness. Finally, two more perhaps to make the point more clear. That's the term used in the Quran, sakina, or tranquility of the heart and the soul.
Equanimity.
Equanimity. In 48:4, it says about God, it is he who sent down tranquility into the hearts of the believers, that they may add faith to their faith. Mm-hmm. Finally, those who believe and whose hearts find satisfaction in the remembrance of God. Lo, in the remembrance of God do hearts find satisfaction.
Beautiful. I don't think we can find more befitting words to close our discussion on monotheism with. Thank you very much, Dr. Jamal. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us today. We hope that you will join us next time when we will start a new series of presentations on the concept of prophethood in Islam. Until we see you next time, may God bless you. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Peace be upon you all.
لا إله إلا الله.